Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan has said that Donald Trump will be an unconventional president. And if Mr. Trump's recent dealings with world leaders are any indication, he will likely live up to those words. On Friday, President-elect Trump stunned the diplomatic community by having a phone conversation with the leader of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen. Washington hasn't officially recognized the Taipei government since 1979, and China reacted quickly, denouncing the contact with Ms. Tsai and warning of an impending confrontation over Taiwan. As Mr. Trump is wont to do, he fired back on Twitter, attacking Chinese taxation of imports, its military buildup in the South China Sea, and Chinese currency. All this, and we are still over a month away from Inauguration Day. We'll take a look at how this latest back and forth might shape future U.S.-Chinese relations. And later, we'll also discuss the president-elect's dealings with other foreign leaders. Lines are open if you've got questions or comments. 888-477-9499 is the number. Or you can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And so we welcome to Radio Times Jacques Delisle, professor of law and professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and deputy director of the University Center for the Study of Contemporary China. Good to have you back with us, Jacques.
Thanks. Great to be back.
So, you know, Donald Trump spoke Friday with Tsai Ing-wen, and she's considered to be leader of Taiwan to some, president to others. In which capacity does the United States recognize her?
Well, the U.S. Tries to avoid terms like president because she formally is the president of the Republic of China, as the government in Taipei that, you know, many, many years ago before 1949 was the government on the mainland as well. But ever since we derecognized, severed diplomatic relations with the Republic of China government in Taipei and established them with the People's Republic of China government in Beijing, we have not had formal relations, and China, the mainland, has pushed very hard against anything that seems to ratchet this back up. So saying things like president is a bit sensitive. Of course, in Taiwan, she is referred to as the president.
Yeah. So a bit of a history lesson. What happened decades ago and that we severed those ties?
Well, this was part of the Nixon opening to China. I mean, it really goes all the way back to the very early 1970s when Kissinger did his secret trip and the wall started coming down, as it were. And, of course, that was driven by Cold War politics, where the U.S. wanted China's assistance in checking the Soviet Union, and Chinese-Soviet relations had been quite horrible for a while. So Mao Zedong, then China's leader, saw a reason for opening to the U.S. as a very pragmatic accommodation. And then over the next several years, it started with the Shanghai communique, the first one coming out of the Nixon visit, which paved the path for where we are now. That communique essentially said the U.S. accepts that Chinese on both sides of the strait, meaning Taiwanese and Chinese, saw that there was one China, and there was just a bit of a dispute about which one it was.
A
little bit. And so in those days, you know, Chiang Kai-shek, the dictator in Taiwan, was still in power, and there was this delusional notion someday of taking back the mainland. Those days are long gone. But that communique is in place. There's a second communique, and then a Reagan-era third communique. The second communique came out in 1979 when we established formal diplomatic relations, normalized relations. And so that meant the U.S. for the first time dealt with the People's Republic of China as a peer government with formal relations. The price of that was to derecognize and to sever our security treaty and sever formal diplomatic ties.
With a democracy.
Well, it was not yet a democracy.
Not at that time.
Right. So that's something that's changed in more recent years. And so that was the end of the Carter administration in 79 when that happened. Congress responded, because Taiwan had a lot of friends in Congress, by passing the Taiwan Relations Act with some cooperation with the administration. And what that does is commit us to treat Taiwan pretty close to as if it were a normal state. So we have something that looks like an embassy, where we take people from the State Department and post them there while they're on leave from the State Department. We agree to sell Taiwan arms of a defensive character. That's in place, too. So we did, by statute and by diplomatic practice, some things which softened the blow and which led to Taiwan having a robust informal relationship with the U.S., but not a formal one. Yeah. Now, in more recent decades, Taiwan has democratized. And so now, certainly from 1992 on, it's a full-fledged democracy, and that's become another basis for the good relations between the U.S. and Taiwan.
So to Donald Trump, the president-elect, is his motivation for talking with Tsai Ing-wen known? really, or are we just speculating?
I think, as with so many things with the president-elect, we're speculating. But I wouldn't purport to be a Trump whisperer. what to make of the tweet? I mean, I think we do know a few things. We do know that this kind of thing plays into what appears to be his style, right? He has very little patience or feels very unconstrained by the conventional ways of doing things, which would have been not to do this, right? The U.S. presidents have not taken U.S. presidents-elect have not taken congratulatory calls from Taiwan. There's been no contact at that level. We also know that he wants to stick it to China to some degree. He wants to show he's going to be tough on China. And this move clearly has both of those components to it. We also know that this was not a call that came out of the blue. That's not the way these things are done. It's not like Tsai Ing-wen picks up the phone call, picks up the telephone in her office in Taipei and says, oh, I think I'll ring up the president-elect. And clearly it was negotiated, and the reporting has borne that out. What we do know is there are people in Trump's circle of Asia policy advisors who, if you look at the spectrum of China experts in the U.S., are definitely, in varying degrees, pretty strongly pro-Taiwan and or anti-China, which isn't quite the same thing. But there was certainly a view that, that among these people that we should take up a level, our level of contact with people in Taiwan, with the government in Taiwan.
Well, is it possible that Mr. Trump might be thinking ahead to use Taiwan as a sort of bargaining chip with China?
It's possible. I think one never knows what to make of the after the event tweets and comments out of the transition group. So, what's come afterwards, does suggest that this is tied into being tough on China. You mentioned the follow up tweets about currency manipulation, barriers to investment, taxes on trade, militarizing the South China Sea. That's sort of the checklist of Trumpian complaints about China's behavior.
Yeah.
And with the exception of the renminbi, the currency manipulation, which is no longer the case in that direction, there's some basis for these things. And there's actually, I think, a decent case to be made for giving Taiwan somewhat better treatment, somewhat higher status than it has had. I mean, there is a quite plausible argument that it is a thriving human rights protecting democracy and a longstanding friend, and so we should treat it, we should give it some status commensurate to the way it behaves in the world. And there is a security argument that we are no longer in the situation we were in 8-10 years ago, when it looked like Taiwan was the most likely cause of an unnecessary crisis in U.S.-China relations. Now we have a lot of other problems in the relationship, and we have a president in Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, who, not quite as much as her predecessor, Ma Ying-jeou, who was there for 8 years, but who is basically wanting to keep things stable and calm in cross-strait relations. That wasn't true in the 2000 to 2008 period as much, but it has been for a while now.
Well, let's parse those tweets from Donald Trump a little bit more, if you would. And I'll read, there are two tweets together in the entirety. He tweets, did China ask us if it was okay to devalue their currency, making it hard for our companies to compete, heavily tax our products going into their country, the U.S. doesn't tax them, or to build a massive military complex in the middle of the South China Sea? I don't think so. And that's from Donald Trump. So let's start with the tariffs first. You saw these figures in the New York Times. China's tariff on imported cars is 25%. The U.S. tariff on imported cars, 2.5%. And apparently there are similar disparities in taxes and on other goods. Does Mr. Trump have a point here in attacking this disparity?
Well, it depends on what your metric is, right? If you're talking about from a standard of liberalized trade and the free flow of goods, then clearly there's an asymmetry there. What China has in the way of tariffs are compliant with its WTO obligations. And basically what the WTO, the World Trade Organization system, requires you to do is it's got a general norm of trade liberalization, but the real requirements are that you treat all of your trading partners equally. So if China has 25% for us and 25% for Germany on cars, then that's permissible. And all of these are negotiated, right? So this is part of the terms of China getting into the WTO, which the U.S. and other then-existing members agreed to. And we may or may not like it. And typically, developing countries get some protectionist measures. China got fewer than a lot of developing countries did, partly because it was so big a trading power. Mm-hmm. So you can certainly criticize that and say that it should be more level. The real problems with trade in China don't lie so much in the obvious rules on the books. They're much more subtle things, and that's, I think, something the Trump administration has to worry about. So if they want to take trade sanctions, sure, they could slap on retaliatory tariffs if Trump slaps a tariff on them, and then we'd wind up in a dispute in front of the WTO. But China has things like, state-linked airlines decide to buy Airbus rather than Boeing. That's not a trade violation, right? The other problem,
and that's what you mean when you say subtle.
Right. There's subtle, and there's also things like, you know, poor protection of intellectual property rights. There are a whole host of issues in the economic relationship that are much less transparent and in some ways much more painful than a simple tariff barrier. The currency manipulation, that's not going on.
All right. You say that charge from Trump Mr. Trump is inaccurate.
It's dated. Okay. China's been, if anything, propping up the currency lately.
So China has been building artificial islands in the South China Sea, some military installations there. The perceived goal here is what on the part of China?
Well, I think China clearly – well, there are a couple things going on. One is this is partly a claim about sovereignty, right? And China has a long history now about saying our territory was encroached on by imperialists going all the way back, certainly the middle 19th century, partly the Europeans, partly Japan. And so these landforms and these marine forms in the South China Sea and the Chinese telling our Chinese territory that was taken, much of it by Japan – a somewhat more complex history, and that is occupied, in their view, improperly by some of China's neighbors. Of course, they have lots of overlapping claims in the sea. We had the big arbitration with the Philippines over the summer that finally got resolved. And so China sees this as a sovereignty issue. What's the strategic goal? You know, China sees the South China Sea as one of its near seas and sees that as the great power in the region, the dominant power in the region, it should have significant control and dominion over that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like the idea that that the openness of those sea lanes and the sort of structure in the area is essentially provided by the U.S. Seventh Fleet. And so they're pushing back, and they've been building up these islands. They have not yet fully militarized them, but there's certainly the capacity to use them as military bases, and they're using them to some degree to that purpose, right? So he probably exaggerated a little bit, but this is a concern, and it's one the Obama administration has been greatly concerned about.
I was just going to ask you what the reaction was, if you could just quickly give us an update.
Well, the Obama administration has condemned the island building. Mm-hmm. It supported the Philippines in the arbitration, and the Philippines, by and large, won the arbitration, which can't solve the sovereignty question. Long, complicated story there, but basically it did reject all Chinese arguments, including those that would have given China a great degree of dominion over the waters in the area and that would have perhaps made permissible some of other Chinese activities, including some of the island building. They rejected all that. So the Obama administration started condemning that and sent our ships, Navy ships, to go quite close in ways that essentially challenged the Chinese claim. The criticism was it was too little, too late.
What does Donald Trump do any differently? If anything.
I think it's tough on the South China Seas. I mean, I think what the U.S. policy options are to just push as hard as one can, to continue with the freedom of navigation operations, to do our best to say that what China is doing is inconsistent with international law. Now, we have a bit of a problem there because we haven't joined the Law of the Sea Treaty. We can claim it still binds anyway as a matter of custom, but it's a weak talking point. And I think, any U.S. president has to pick what issues he's going to put priority on in dealing with China. What ones do you really want to push on? Currency manipulation, that's a loser as far as the facts go. But where do you rank cooperation on North Korea? Where do you rank militarization of South China Sea? Those are tough strategic choices that people have to make.
All right, we're starting off the hour by talking about future U.S.-Chinese relations under President Trump. Mr. Trump, of course, spoke with Taiwan's leader over the weekend, making some waves. Here with us through the next 20 minutes or so, Jacques Delisle, Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, also Director of the Asian Foreign Policy Research Institute. Do I have that correct? Okay, thank you so much. We'll also be joined by David Rothkopf, CEO and editor for the FP Group, and Jeet Heer, Senior Editor for The New Republic. After the break, stay with us. There's more of Radio Times straight ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. With us in studio, Jacques Delisle, who is director of the Asian program for the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and also professor of law and professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. We are also joined now by David Rothkopf, who is a CEO and editor for the FP Group, which publishes a foreign policy magazine. Welcome to Radio Times, David.
My pleasure.
And also, Jeet Heer is senior editor for The New Republic. Nice to have you along, Jeet.
Good to be here.
So why don't we begin this segment of Radio Times just with your reaction to President-elect Trump's conversation with Tsai Ing-wen. Jeet, what did you think when you first heard of the conversation?
Well, it was really startling because it is a shift in policy. And I think the way it was done is more problematic than what was done. Like, I mean, I don't think there's anything necessarily sacrosanct about a one China policy or about not recognizing Taiwan. But to have like a president-elect, you know, do this in the form of, you know, like an unannounced phone call, and then once it becomes news, to say, well, you know, she called me, which was the talking point for a while, it really indicated a level of sort of unpredictability, which I think is the problematic aspect. I mean, I do think, you know, like in foreign policy, you can change policy. There's nothing that's necessary, and there's a defensible case to be made for more formal relations with Taiwan. But the way it was done was very troubling.
David Rothkopf, the way it was done, the tone of the conversation, the following tweets, why don't you weigh in on that?
Well, I think everything about it was worrisome, and I think, you know, I don't have quite as charitable a view. First of all, it's a policy that's been standing for 45 years. The reason it's been standing is reason. That has been debated by Republicans and Democrats alike, and they've come to the conclusion that perhaps we ought not to get too deeply involved on behalf of Taiwan because of the many, many complex and long-term interests we have with China. But setting aside the foreign policy merits, which I'd be happy to come back to, first of all, we have a tradition in this country of one president at a time, and this president-elect decided he was going to make foreign policy off the cuff while he was president-elect. Secondly, he lied about the call and said that it was made to him and it was made outgoing. Thirdly, it shocked the Chinese. There was no preparation for it in any way. Fourthly, he overlooks conveniently, as he had in some prior meetings, the economic interests that the Trump Organization may have had in Taiwan. And fifth, it completes a pattern that existed in the calls that he made with leaders in Pakistan and Duterte in the Philippines and Nawaz Sharif in Pakistan and even with fellow Western Alliance leaders like Theresa May, in which Trump was unprepared, off the cuff, making statements that were not in the national interest, promising things that he couldn't deliver. And behaving in a way kind of that was an unguided missile with regard to U.S. foreign policy. And it suggests that he is, you know, both incompetent and ill-considered when it comes to these issues.
If this off-the-cuff style were to continue past Inauguration Day next month, what are the ramifications, Jacques Delisle?
Well, I think it makes it very difficult, and I think you're seeing this in the reactions in Beijing and Taipei to the series of tweets following the phone call.
Well, right? Even internationally, because David mentioned a number of other foreign leaders that Mr. Trump had spoken.
Right. I think this is a microcosm. I think it is throwing out the playbook, right, which I know he loves to do, but there are certainly costs to throwing out the playbook. And again, you're seeing this in Beijing's reaction to the Taiwan tweet. They tried to give a climb down. They said, oh, we think this is a trick by Taiwan. You know, they sort of set up the phone call. That was when the Trump people were trying to put it down to that. And they said, well, you know, we're warning you to stick with the one China principle, the three communiques and all of that, which was essentially a tougher line, but also saying this is the moment to give us the reassurance that you're not departing from what has been bedrock policy for 40 years or so. So, I mean, to have a formal contact of a president-elect with the president on Taiwan is not so radical. I mean, it's, you know, it's an upgrading, but it's not a crazy upgrading. And we've seen things that come somewhat close to that in the past, though not all the way. So, you know, Ronald Reagan talked about normalizing relations, re-normalizing before he became president. He invited some officials from Taiwan to his inaugural, that sort of thing. You know, we had the Lee Teng-hui visit, which the Clinton administration allowed the then president of Taiwan to speak to his college reunion at Cornell. So we've had things that have roiled the waters in the past. George W. Bush said we'll do whatever it took to defend Taiwan. But what happens then is once you say that, you climb down. You say there's no fundamental change in policy. Yeah. And that's what Beijing is looking for. They're not getting it from Trump. And by the way, it's what Taiwan is looking for. Tsai Ing-wen this morning, she said yesterday, well, today, Taipei time, met with reporters and said, we don't see this as a fundamental change in the policy. They wanted an incremental move up, and they got something where China with this call, the rest of the world with all the other calls is going, what do we make of this? And we don't really know.
Do you see, Jeet, here, with the choice of the eventual choice of Mr. Trump's Secretary of State, of this freewheeling style perhaps being reined in?
Well, it really depends on who the Secretary of State is. I mean, I would imagine if it was Mitt Romney, there might be a change. But there's certainly talk of other people like John Bolton who might not like rein in Mr. Trump. And in fact, I mean, Bolton is very much a sort of China hawk and might have been one of the people encouraging this policy. But beyond that, I mean, the thing is, the Secretary of State is, like, you know, lower on the totem pole than the president. Mm-hmm. Whatever the president says is very, very important. You know, whatever the president tweets is very important. People pay attention to words. And I think the other thing is, I mean, on the one hand, this is very startling what he's done. But on the other hand, it's not startling. He said all along that his goal was unpredictability, that he feels that, you know, America would be better if it was seen as a more unpredictable country. And he was going to be an unpredictable president. And I think that presents real problems because the whole goal of American foreign policy since going back to Franklin Roosevelt, when America really became, you know, the global superpower and the cornerstone of global capitalism, has been to try to create a stable international order. And so now we're getting an American president who I think for the first time since the 1930s really doesn't want that role and wants America to be a kind of rogue superpower. I think that's the largest worry.
Well, it's tough to imagine that members of the Republican Party, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, Vice President-elect Mike Pence, they're holding their tongues now regarding Donald Trump. But moving forward, once the administration finds its feet, not trying to somehow tone it down a little bit. David Rothkopf, do you see that?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. They held their tongues on racism. They held their tongues on Islamophobia. They held their tongues on misogyny. They held their tongues on conflicts of interest. They seem to be more adept at holding their tongues than actually standing up for the principles that they allegedly ran on at one particular point. Could this change? Yeah, there's some signs that it might. You know, Trump went into a place that you never go into in the Republican Party, which is to sort of throw down with against corporate interests by saying that he was going to impose a tariff on companies that were relocating jobs overseas. And you've already seen some members of the Republican Party say, we're not going to go there. And I think on some other issues like, you know, another of his foreign policy freelancing bits has been with Russia, and there's a big chunk in the Republican Party that is very uncomfortable with the degree to which Trump is cozy with Putin and wants to make nice there. And so I think, you know, gradually over time, as the, you know, fundamental flaws in these policies come to the fore, the impracticality of some of them, the dangers of some of them, you might start seeing fragmentation. The question is how quickly that happens, yeah, how resolute they are in standing up to him, and whether that in fact makes any difference on a president-elect and future president who doesn't really seem to care.
Let's get back to China for just a moment before we move elsewhere in the world. As you alluded to, Jacques Delisle, you know, following the initial response from the Chinese Foreign Ministry, there was a scathing denouncement of Mr. Trump in an editorial of the People's Daily, which is with the mouthpiece of the Communist Party, warning that, quote, creating troubles for the China-U.S. relationship is creating troubles for the U.S. itself. What sorts of troubles are the writers possibly alluding to here?
Well, there are a number of measures that China can take. I mean, one of the concerns that a lot of people who watch China policy have about Trump is the question about whether he understands that there is a certain Pyrrhic victory quality to any measures to be taken against China, right? So, you know, he seems to have this vision that we just need to get them to raise the value of their currency. We can throw up barriers to their imports to the U.S. And, you know, that's just not the way the world works. Many of those imports are from U.S. companies that have operations in China. Many things produced in the U.S. are part of a global supply chain that gets things from China. China can as I said earlier, refused to would sort of steer the state-linked company's purchases of very high value-added, important American exports like airplanes. There are lots of ways of pushing there. China also can make things very uncomfortable in the Western Pacific. I mean, they really could do things like land some fighter aircraft, station a lot more military equipment on the South China Sea Islands. That puts us to a very tough choice, especially in a moment where the allies in the region, the friends in the region, are already a little worried about the American commitment, given what Trump had to say about Japan and South Korea and defend yourselves or pay more or perhaps get a bomb. That might be okay. I mean, when you start talking that kind of language, people are not as confident.
Yeah.
And if China tests, then what does the U.S. do? Do we push back or not? It can create some real difficulties. And Taiwan is also a target. I mean, I think one of the reasons you saw Tsai Ing-wen trying to say, look, we're not trying to seek a really major policy change here. We just want a little more face, a little more status, partly because China's starting to squeeze us a bit more. You know, because the risk is Taiwan will be one of those targets of things that China could do. I mean, Taiwan's heavily dependent economically. It wouldn't take much to really shake the place. So even short of things that look overtly military, you've got economic measures and you've got military posturing, security posturing that makes things tough for the U.S.
All right, let's get to the phones. Rick in Hockessin is live now with us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick.
Thank you, and interesting comments. I did not vote for Mr. Trump, even though I'm a Republican. I voted for Hillary. But and that said, I would like to remind you that Eisenhower, when he was elected as president-elect, he made a promise in his campaign to visit the Korean Peninsula and close the war, which China was heavily, heavily involved in. And he did this, just that. He went there. And as a general and president-elect, and then as he when he became president, he closed the war. And I think I sense a bit of a hand-wringing from the group. And I'm going to give Mr. Trump a year to see how he does. And we've been pushed around. We pushed them, and now they're pushing back. So maybe we ought to give the guy a chance. And I don't like people saying that he's a crook and all of that. Let's give the guy a chance.
All right, Rick, thank you so much. We appreciate the call to Radio Times and your comment. And it's interesting. And David Rothkopf, two things here. Perhaps something of a comparison to Eisenhower. And also give Donald Trump a year. Give him a chance. What is your reaction?
Well, first of all, the comparison between Eisenhower and Trump is fatuous on every level. I mean, Eisenhower was an experienced international player. He had been the Supreme Allied Commander. He was a man of the temperament to lead, the ability to manage large organizations in the U.S. government, a lot of international experience, and made judgments in a very, very thoughtful, reasoned out way with very, very clear processes. Trump is none of those things. Secondly, in terms of giving him a chance, you know, we don't have a choice but to give him a chance. But the reality is that so far Donald Trump has in 3 or 4 weeks on multiple occasions done things that are deeply disturbing. And you can't just sort of say, well, if he says it's okay for me to have all these conflicts of interest, let's give him a year and see how bad that gets. Or if he says let's let Russia do whatever it wants in Syria, or let's provoke the Chinese without thinking about our mutual interests. And, you know, people talk about hand-wringing, but the reality is that the United States and China are quite different from any other relationship with any other major rival that we've ever had in terms of the degree of the interdependence that we have and the degree to which we need the Chinese to achieve our issues and our goals, whether it's in North Korea, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's with the economy, whether it's with climate, et cetera. It's not the same situation. And so there's a long list of issues where if we give Donald Trump a year, he can do a lot of damage. So what I say is, you know, listen carefully, support him where he deserves support. He made a good choice with General Mattis as Secretary of Defense. Let's support him on that. And where he is posing an imminent risk, respond quickly, because we all have skin in the game in terms of the consequences of his actions.
Sanjeet here, what is your take?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what David is saying, that there's a kind of big difference with Eisenhower. But I think there's also the whole issue of norms, that there are sort of rules by which foreign policy has been conducted by the United States. And I think to the extent that Trump ran as a change candidate and he said he's going to be unpredictable, he sort of has the right to do this. Like, he is being unpredictable. But I think we also, American citizens and people around the world, such as myself, have the right to note that he's changing norms. He's actually doing stuff that is like a real break from the way things have been done before. And when you and we can both note that norms are being broken, and then also like argue for what the risks are. Like, I think an unpredictable American president who is sort of making all American alliances more uncertain is going to create a much more dangerous world. I think that's a very reasonable argument, and I think it's one that should be made.
Now, Jacques DeLille, we only have
I made it.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. David, go ahead.
I'm sorry. May I make a break point? You know, unpredictability is one thing, and we have to be aware of that, and changing norms is another, and I think we have to be aware of that. There's some other things that I think are predictable and that we have to be worried about. If you appoint an Islamophobe as your national security advisor, then you're likely to get Islamophobia every day of the week. If you appoint a guy who is the head of a kind of white supremacist, ethno-nationalist news organization as your chief strategist, then you're likely to get that every day of the week. Mm. If you allied yourself with Russia throughout your campaign and papered it over, you're likely to get that every day of the week. There are some things that are within the realm of variations between one administration and another. But some of what's happening with Donald Trump is not normal. It is dangerous, and it needs to be called out for that. And we do ourselves a disservice by falling back into the kind of language of the traditional discussion about a transition between administrations, when some of this is truly aberrant and it looks like it's baked into the cake.
All right, David, the point is taken. We're going to have to say thanks and goodbye to Jacques DeLille for his participation in this conversation. Jacques is professor of law and professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to talk about, continue our conversation about President-elect Trump and his conversations not only with the leaders of China and Taiwan, but with others around the world after the break. David Rothkopf stays with us through the end of the hour. He is CEO and editor for the FP Group, and Jeet here is senior editor for The New Republic. And as always, if you'd like to jump into the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499 is the number, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Radio Times continues in a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are taking a look at President-elect Donald Trump's unorthodox conversations with foreign leaders and our guests for the remainder of the hour. Jeet here, senior editor for The New Republic, and David Rothkopf is CEO and editor for the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy Magazine. And he's also the author of four books, most recently, International Insecurity. And lines are open, 888-477-9499, if you would like to join us. So so Russia came up just a few moments ago in our conversation. And is the seeming bromance, if you will, between Russian President Vladimir Putin and President-elect Trump cooling off? In his national address to the nation, to Russia, Putin seemed to express some discomfort over Mr. Trump's prior statements on nuclear weapons. What do you think, Jeet?
Well, we're going to have to wait and see. But I do think that if Putin had perhaps given some support for Trump during the campaign as a, you know, sort of destabilizing move, he might have bought something that's much more than he expected. That is to say, like, even Russia might want a more stable American president. And the very unpredictability that Trump is introducing might worry Putin. I think there's some signs of that. Like, I've seen stuff in the Russian media that sort of indicates that they don't know what to make of him. I will say one thing, though. I think Trump's unpredictability will make it easier for him to work with Putin, but also with other sort of autocrats. That is to say, I think a predictable foreign policy works best for making alliances with fellow democracies, with, say, you know, the Europeans, with India, with Japan. But an unpredictable foreign policy is something that autocratic governments, which are themselves unpredictable, which are themselves into sort of deal-making and living in the present, can go along with. And I think we see some signs of that in the Middle East, in the Philippines, perhaps even in sort of Hungary, where sort of more autocratic governments are thinking that they can get along with Trump.
What do you think, David? Unpredictability, perhaps positive here?
I don't know. You know, when I look at Trump,
I just want to correct that. I don't think it's positive. I think that the unpredictability makes it more likely that the U.S. will be aligned with autocrats. I don't think that's a good thing.
All right. I stand corrected on that one, Gene. Sorry about that. All right. Well, let's get to the Philippines then. President-elect Trump has spoken by phone with Rodrigo Duterte, and Duterte saying Trump congratulated him on his war on drugs, which is controversial because thousands of people have died in this crackdown. Duterte's relationship with President Obama is hostile. So what do you make of the conversation that Mr. Trump had with the Philippine president? David?
Look, Duterte is a murderous lunatic. If you were making a list of, you know, the five, you know, sort of wackiest, most troubling leaders on the planet right now, he might make it into that list. Even though he's been in office a relatively short time, his anti-drug spree has killed over 1,000 people. It has been absolutely bloody and really sort of outside the bounds of what a state's behavior ought to be. You know, the fact that Trump went in and embraced this guy on its face is bad policy. And that's something that we need to keep in mind in all of this discussion. We can talk about Trump and his personality and whether it's good or whether it's bad, but we also need to talk about whether the positions he's taking are good positions. The position on Taiwan is not a good position. Embracing a guy like Duterte and sort of sending a message to him, you know, that, you know, what you're doing is now got the blessing of the richest, most powerful nation on earth, that's not a good thing. We also have the fact that the Trump Organization has a big project in Manila. And, you know, again, they don't want to talk about that. They're saying these things are separate. But, you know, look at the people he's talked to. Look at the change in the status of the Trump Organization projects in the world over the course of the past couple of weeks. Somebody, his family, is benefiting from this. And I think that's a problem. But I also think Jeet's point is a very important one, and that is that Trump has been sending consistently a message to autocrats around the world that he is going to be perfectly comfortable dealing with them regardless of their behavior, whether it's in Central Asia, whether it's a guy like Duterte, whether it's Putin. He's going to be very, very self-interested. In fact, I think if you're looking for predictability for Trump, try and figure out what his self-interest is, and you're most likely to figure out where he's going to go.
What do you think about that, Jeet? What's your reaction?
Yeah, no, I think that that sounds exactly right. I think the issue of Trump's self-dealing and the sort of kleptocratic tendencies of, you know, keeping this global family empire going while he's president can't be disentangled from foreign policy. And I think in the case of the Philippines as well, I believe that one of their business associates is now going to be Manila's representative in Washington. So, there's like all sorts of very disturbing tendencies.
Let's take a look then at President-elect Trump's face-to-face meeting a little bit back with the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, a few weeks ago. Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka was there. Her inclusion, you know, raised more than a few eyebrows. The Trump children were immensely involved in their campaign, and the three oldest will ostensibly manage the business empire while Mr. Trump is in the White House. What might have been the impropriety here, if any? Jeet, do you see anything there?
Well, there's an added element of impropriety, which is that Ivanka Trump is one of her businesses is making a deal with a corporation that's owned by the Japanese government. So, I think that, like, I mean, even the term conflict of interest doesn't quite cover it. Like, you know, this is a clearly self-interested move to have a private individual, you know, sit in on a government meeting with a government that they're, you know, going to be profiting from. I think that we're in a whole new territory here, and I think we've it would be less worrisome if there was some sort of check. Like, Congress, in theory, could check all this right now. They could pass laws. They could force Mr. Trump to, you know, divest his holdings. But there's every indication that they're not going to do that. It's a Republican Congress, and they feel that, you know, as long as Mr. Trump goes along with their other policies, they're going to let him do this.
So, Jeet, that was my next question. Self-interest, perhaps, but illegal... No.
Well, I believe that the constitutional issue here is a political one. That is to say, the impeachment is both a political process and a legal one. Congress gets to decide what is an impeachable offense. In theory, these conflicts of interest could be impeachable, like right now. He could be impeached, the day he is sworn in. If Congress decides to make it an impeachable offense. But, I mean, that's a political decision, and there's no reason to think that they will do that.
David Rothkopf, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think it raises the stakes for the midterm elections in 2 years, because I think if Trump continues on this tack and he alienates a lot of people and midterm elections go the way midterm elections go and the Democrats contain get control of one or both houses of Congress, it's going to change the equation on issues of impeachment quite a bit. You know, I think, you know, the Constitution of the United States doesn't really address conflicts of interest for the president, with one exception, in large part, I think, because the founders never dreamed anybody would be so crass. But, you know, there is the Emoluments Clause, and the Emoluments Clause says that the president and no other official in the government can accept payments or gifts from foreign governments, and a number of cases have already taken place. The Bahrainis, the Azerbaijanis are holding parties at the Trump Hotel, which indirectly benefits Trump. Some of these projects are getting the green light in other countries, which directly benefits President-elect Trump. So I think, you know, the moment he actually is sworn in, he's in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. And I think that's something to keep an eye on, because that's going to be fodder for somebody.
For somebody, but not necessarily Republicans in Congress?
Well, they have not shown a great deal of desire to undertake, you know, challenging President-elect Trump. If all of a sudden his popularity were to plunge, you know, these guys would wet their fingers, stick it in the wind, and go, maybe we'll move in the other direction, because that's the way Washington goes. But right now, you know, they're sending a message to a kind of narcissistic, megalomaniacal guy of, you know, have at it, fella. And I think that could lead to problems and tears in months to come.
All right, let's get to some calls. Bailey joins us from Bucks County. Welcome to Radio Times, Bailey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am so with David on this holding Trump's feet to the fire, and I think the example he just used is a perfect one to point out the Republican Party's innate hypocrisy. They were so outraged that Bill Clinton would hop on the plane and have a discussion with our attorney general, but they are, of course, now mute as he gives approval to a barbarian in the Philippines. And never mind that his own national security advisor, a guy who was fired for mental instability in the first place, retweeted that ridiculous fake news story about Hillary and the pedophile ring. Now you have a coffee and sandwich shop in Northwest Washington getting death threats to its employees, a bunch of people who make coffee and sandwiches, because our national security advisor won't disavow a story that he retweeted during the campaign. And never mind the fact that you appoint a guy who would retweet this story in the first place. You know, what we have is a bunch of sycophants and novices being appointed to. How did Ben Carson in 2 weeks get the skill and ability to manage an agency that just 2-3 weeks ago he said he couldn't manage.
Bailey, you've got a lot to this comment, and we appreciate the call into Radio Times. David, there's some pretty intense emotion there, but what do you think of some of the points that Bailey made?
Well, let's strip away the emotion. Steve Bannon ran Breitbart, which was anti-Semitic, misogynistic. Mike Flynn said that Islam was a cancer. Steve Bannon has no government experience. Trump has no government experience. Priebus has no government experience. Jeff Sessions was kept from approval as a federal judge because he's a racist and has taken publicly racist stances. Ben Carson was made Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, or nominated to be Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, with no government experience, no experience in housing, no experience in urban development. Nikki Haley has been named UN, the nominee for the UN ambassadorship, which has been elevated again to cabinet level, with zero foreign policy experience. You know, the list goes on and on and on. And, you know, I think, you know, at a certain point, we have to stop and say, if you have a president with no experience, appointing advisors with no experience, and a huge amount of self-interest, let's not talk about Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury nominee's bank, evicting a woman because she was 27 cents off in her mortgage payment, and the number of Wall Street fat cats that have been brought into this supposedly populist administration. And you've got to say, this is not normal. These are not political differences that separate us from these people. Emotion set aside leaves us with inexperienced people with very bad views on the record, right, dubious track records, and interests that are at odds with the American people taking top jobs. And that requires an unemotional but nonetheless emphatic response.
All right. Let's get a couple of comments in before we get to the top of the hour here. A comment from Debbie, who says, for people who say to give Trump a chance, he's already had a chance and he's blown it. Another listener says, the man is not in office yet and you start programs bashing him. Your candidate lost big. Move on. And then we have a comment from John, who says, in regard to the numbers killed by Duterte, Trump is trying to protect us from the Mexican and South American cartels, which probably kill more people. Do you think that really that is what is behind President-elect Trump's conversation with Mr. Duterte, Janet or Ajit here? Sorry?
Well, I do think it's hard to know his exact motives, but yeah, I do think that there's a kind of element of sort of where Trump has run as a strong man, and therefore he feels he should align himself with other strong men throughout the world. Duterte has that sort of quality to it. So I think that, but I mean, that's going to lead the United States in a very troubling direction where, you know, a country that, however flawed, has tried to argue for a policy of human rights and democracy promotion is now flipping towards something very, very different, which is that, you know, America is set to become the world leader of reaction in alliance with Putin's Russia.
Right. And one more quick point before we wrap up here. How will a President Trump need to shape U.S. relations back to China here with China in order to help curb North Korea's nuclear missile capability? David Rothkopf?
Well, in order to help curb North Korea's nuclear missile capability, we actually need North Korea's principal sponsor to assist us in that. And once again, that's China. So if you take the North Korea threat seriously, then you need to find a way to get the Chinese to cooperate. And the best way to get the Chinese to cooperate is not necessarily starting out by sticking a thumb in their eye. We need the Chinese in North Korea. We need the Chinese with their growing influence in the Middle East. We need the Chinese on climate. We need the Chinese to manage the global economy. We need the Chinese because they buy our products. We need the Chinese because they sell cheap products to Americans that are affordable. So, you know, I think what the president-elect needs to start doing is start making a list of what our national interests are and acting in a way that's consistent with them.
All right, David Rothkopf, thank you so much for joining us for this part of Radio Times.
My pleasure.
David is a CEO and editor for the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy magazine. And our thanks to you as well, Jeet, here.
Thank you.
Ajit Hir is senior editor for The New Republic. And don't forget, visit our Facebook page, take a listen to our podcasts. You can find it all at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.